The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
First, you need to know what's in the oath. And broadly speaking, it's the notion that we pledge, swear, affirm to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. What's missing from the oath, which by the way is mandated from Congress, is a pledge to any particular person or party or president. The law enforcement environment in which I grew up was not bipartisan, it was nonpartisan. And bipartisan makes no sense in that context. Nonpartisan makes sense. And so, you know, it struck me when I was listening to people talk about Jim Comey or Bob Mueller on the air, and they would describe them as, you know, Republicans or Democrats, whatever they described them as. And in many cases, I never thought of them that way, I didn't know that. And that might strike people as odd. I worked for Bob Mueller and didn't know his political party. But in fact, Ben, I worked for Bob Mueller and didn't know his political party.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 21st, 2019. Chuck Rosenberg is a former U.S. attorney, former senior FBI official, and the former acting head of the DEA. He is now an analyst with NBC News and MSNBC. He also has a podcast with MSNBC called The Oath with Chuck Rosenberg. The podcast draws its name from the oath of office which many public servants take upon their entry into government service. In the podcast, Chuck speaks with other former government officials about their careers, pivotal moments they witnessed in history, and what drew them to public service. He sat down with Benjamin Wittes this week to discuss his podcast, his career in government service, and his thoughts on the oath of office. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 419, Chuck Rosenberg on the Oath.
So we don't usually have podcasts about other podcasts, but this seems like one of the rare times that's appropriate. You have a new podcast, Chuck.
I do, and thank you for making that exception, Ben. I'm really glad you would do that for me.
Of course. So tell us about it. And for those listeners who haven't listened to it, first of all, you should. It's called The Oath. Tell us about the podcast.
Yeah, the idea was to talk to really interesting people about stuff other than what made them household names, right? A lot of my guests have been in the news a lot lately for current stuff. But they've had long, interesting careers in government, remarkable legacies of public service, and stories that illustrate well sort of the values and the the way they think about the rule of law and criminal justice that I thought were important to tell.
All right. So give us some examples. Who have you had on so far, and what haven't they been talking about when they came on?
The second question is easier. What they have not been talking about, by and large, is current events. The first question I've had so far, Jim Comey, Andy McCabe, Preet Bharara, Lisa Monaco, and then the episode that drops next Wednesday and we release on Wednesdays is Jim Baker, the former general counsel of the FBI.
And so all of those people are people who have been sometimes dramatically in the news, sometimes less dramatically in the news. And I take it and from the episodes that I've listened to, you're not talking to Preet about, you know, getting fired by Donald Trump. You're not talking to Jim Comey about his relationship with Trump or the Russia investigation. You're talking to people about the larger arcs of their careers.
That's right. Ironically, maybe perhaps coincidentally, but not by plan, my first three guests all wrote books, were all fired. Jim Comey, who wrote Higher Loyalty, Andy McCabe, who wrote The Threat, and Preet Bharara, who wrote Doing Justice. For instance, in Jim Comey's book, which is wonderful and people ought to read it, very little of that book has to do with the president, Jim's interactions with the president, or the fact of his firing. A lot of the book, in fact, in my view, some of the best parts of the book have much more to do with how Jim grew up in New Jersey, how he was bullied as a kid, you know, experiences he had as a young prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, the fact that Jim was a victim of a very serious and heinous crime when he was in high school. Those are the types of things that I think make Jim Jim or Ben Ben or you you. And they're worth talking about.
So I would say like 80% of your interview with Jim was about two things. One was his encounter with the so-called Ramsey rapist when he was a teenager. And the other is his experiences with mobsters. There's a lot of stuff in that book, including, you know, the whole confrontation over the Stellar Wind stuff, you know, his relationship with Barack Obama. Those two parts of the book, which are actually all within the first sort of third of the book, I agree they are some of the most interesting components of the book. But what stood out about them for you? Why are they the parts that you focused on?
Well, I'll let you and your listeners in on a little secret. There was so much material to cover with Jim, we actually created two episodes. And so the last episode of season one will be Comey Part Two.
I see.
And we'll cover some of those other things. But again, largely staying away from current events. It's very hard to be current. I mean, Lawfare does an amazing job of that, an amazing job of being current, not just in writing, but also via this medium through podcasts. We didn't attempt that. There's lots of good, smart people who do that. We wanted to take a step back and talk to people, as I said earlier, about what informed their judgment, shaped their values, how Ben became Ben.
All right. So one of the other interesting things about this podcast, which I assume is influenced actually by Preet Bharara's podcast, although, you know, correct me if that's wrong, but is that it is a pretty deep process tracing interview kind of format for a mass audience. So unlike, like I think of like the people who do that kind of interview is like Lawfare, right? And then Preet started doing that kind of interview with the idea of reaching a very large audience and has done it. And this is a podcast produced by MSNBC, right? It's not a niche audience kind of thing. It's like they've made a decision that Chuck Rosenberg talking to this type of person is actually a mass market proposition. Yeah. That is not an obvious proposition to me as somebody who does this, you know, for a living. It's clearly right, but it's not obvious. Walk me through it. What's the judgment that like you talking to Lisa Monaco is going to be, that's not a slight on either you or Lisa Monaco, but is going to be something that very large numbers of people want to listen to?
Well, so far, large numbers of people have listened, including to Lisa Monaco, which, by the way, is a smart thing to do because Lisa's—
Yeah, Lisa's sharp.
Lisa's a very sharp woman. But, you know, Andy McCabe and Preet Bharara and Jim Comey are very sharp guys. And so I guess I'm pleased but not shocked that people would want to hear what they have to say. As for MSNBC, look, they do news really well. They don't need me to do news. I know I appear on their network. I'm grateful for that. But they don't need me to create another news program. And so when I was discussing this project with them, and they've been incredibly supportive, we recognized that there was a bit of a void. Preet does it really well. I don't mean to suggest nobody's out there doing it, but that there are interesting people with interesting stories to tell. And MSNBC gave me a platform to do it. And so far, the numbers have been good. MSNBC remains supportive. Hey, I know it could all end tomorrow, but so far, so good.
All right, let's talk about the concept of the oath. So I've been, as I told you before we started recording, the oath is a important component of the book that Susan Hennessy and I have just finished writing, although that's the presidential oath.
But not dissimilar.
Not dissimilar. In fact, deeply similar. You've organized the podcast around the oath of office. So justify that.
Sure. So first, you need to know what's in the oath. And broadly speaking, it's the notion that we pledge, swear, affirm to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. What's missing from the oath, which, by the way, is mandated from Congress, is a pledge to any particular person or party or president. The law enforcement environment in which I grew up was not bipartisan, it was nonpartisan. And bipartisan makes no sense in that context. Nonpartisan makes sense. And so, you know, it struck me when I was listening to people talk about Jim Comey or Bob Mueller on the air, and they would describe them as, you know, Republicans or Democrats, whatever they described them as, that in many cases, I had not only had I never thought of them that way, I didn't know that. And that might strike people as odd. I worked for Bob Mueller and didn't know his political party. But in fact, Ben, I worked for Bob Mueller and didn't know his political party. It's not something that ever came up in the offices in which I worked. And so one way of capturing that was to talk about the oath, both what's in it and decidedly what's not in it.
All right. So let's talk about the oath, because I think there's a quality of the oath that for those people for whom it's meaningful, it's super meaningful.
Right.
And for a lot of people, it's like signing, or at least from the outside, it's like signing your paperwork that you're starting a job. And so my first question is, when you say the oath, you organize it around the oath, how much of that is a conceit and how much of that is an ideological position or reality on your part that this is actually meaningful to swear this oath?
It is actually meaningful to swear the oath. And in my case, I had the privilege of administering it many times, both when I was a U.S. attorney and when I ran the DEA. Just going back a little bit, though, Ben, I've asked most of my guests, but not all of my guests, about the first time they took the oath. And I was struck by how they responded. Andy McCabe, for instance, remembered it vividly. He said it was on the first night that he arrived at Quantico as a brand new special agent in training, and everybody had to assemble in a room together. And you didn't show up in shorts and a T-shirt. You dressed as for business. And that they took it together as a class. And he described it as something he would never forget and incredibly impactful, in part because he was taking it with a bunch of brand new FBI special agents. Every time I ask that question, when did you first take the oath? People don't say, don't remember that. I have no idea. They tell me exactly where they were and who administered it and what they were thinking. And so as corny as it may sound, I come out of a world where it is really meaningful.
And why is it meaningful? So it is, you know, at one level, it's a civic ritual. At another level, it's just a set of words. At another level, it is something super meaningful. Justify it as meaningful other than as a weird kind of civic ritual.
Well, there is a ritualistic aspect to it, but it's a promise, right? You're going to abide by the rules. You're going to defend the Constitution of the United States without fear or favor. And again, I think it's important to think about what's not in the oath, which is the notion that it's not a pledge to a particular party or person. You know, I've worked under many different attorneys general from both parties, not that it ever mattered one bit to me, but none of them have ever elicited a promise or a pledge, to my knowledge, from anybody to be faithful to that party or to that set of policies or to the president in office at the time. It was to something deeper and more meaningful. So again, I get it. It sounds corny, but that's how I think about it.
Have you ever read George Washington's second inaugural address?
I have.
So,
but do not ask me to recite parts of it.
No, I'm going to actually read you the entire thing, not because it will be new to you, because it'll be new to a lot of listeners.
And is this something you talk about in your forthcoming book?
We quoted, but I think it's an interesting illustration. I mean, the significance of this is that the entirety of the inaugural address is concerned with the oath. It reads, "I am again called upon by the voice of my country to execute the functions of its chief magistrate. When the occasion proper for it shall arrive, I shall endeavor to express the high sense I entertain of this distinguished honor and the confidence which has been reposed in me by the people of the United States. Previous to the execution of any official act of the president, the Constitution requires an oath of office. This oath I am now about to take and in your presence, that if it shall be found during my administration of the government, I have in any instances violated willingly or knowingly the injunction thereof, I may, besides incurring the constitutional punishment, be subject to the upbraidings of all who are now witness of the solemn present ceremony."
In your presence and all who are now witness. And that's another component of it. That's another aspect of it that's really important. Andy McCabe described taking it with his classmates when we swore in new AUSAs in the Eastern District of Virginia. When I got sworn in as a brand new AUSA in Norfolk, Virginia, we did it in open court with a federal judge, and my new colleagues came and sat in the courtroom and witnessed it. I took that oath in their presence. So I'm not just swearing, right, to uphold the Constitution of the United States. I'm making a promise to all my colleagues at the same time. You know, those words of George Washington resonate for me. You do it publicly. It's a public oath. It's not a private oath.
So oaths are a funny thing, right? So in the founding generation, the oath, they really believed in oaths. They had kind of religious, still had real religious overtones, as they do for many people today, but it's not nearly as universal. And of course, now oaths have certain legal consequences, particularly with respect to testimony, mm-hmm. but we're not an honor culture. And so there's not this sort of sense that, well, you've sworn an oath.
I disagree slightly, Ben. I think in many ways we are an honor culture, at least in the law. For instance, if I were to issue a grand jury subpoena to Lawfare, then you would reply to it, you would respond to it by producing the things I asked for. I mean, if I didn't really trust you, I would execute a search warrant. But by and large, we give subpoenas so people will comply with them without being sort of further policed. When a witness takes a stand in the criminal trial, she promises to tell the truth. I mean, we don't really have a way to gauge that other than through cross-examination. But that's a promise. It's an oath. When jurors are sworn in at the beginning of a trial, they promise to put aside any predisposition they may have and to just judge the case on the facts adduced at trial. So I would say that in part it is an honor system.
That's interesting. I think there's a sense – so there is certainly a sense in which the legal system still relies on that. On the other hand, we're not a society that fights duels over honor matters anymore, right? We're not
– honor in that sense, yes. You're right.
And I wonder if one of the things that – and this is something I've been wondering about as I've listened to the episodes, you know, that focus on an oath as a matter of honor kind of driving a lot of professional judgments and this idea that people who have sworn this oath – are actually different from people who haven't. And so you've organized a whole podcast around that difference, right? And I, first of all, I suspect you are correct that the, just as military service distinguishes people who have served from people who haven't, there is actually something about that oath that is actually makes a difference in the lives of people who have sworn it versus those who've not. It's not simply a gateway to public service.
I think that's right. And so, but I don't think of it as people who took the oath are better than people who didn't take the oath. I think people who took the oath have a different orientation to their work. Don't know if that's causative or correlative. You know, it's entirely possible that people drawn to public service, whether it's law enforcement or the intelligence community or in the military, right, are those who are more oriented in that direction. But, and again, I have to reiterate this, there's lots of people who serve and serve well in many capacities in society, nurses and doctors and teachers and EMTs, all sorts of people, right, who abide by fundamental principles, who have strong moral compasses, who simply didn't take an oath perhaps for their work. So it's not better or worse, but I think it is different.
All right. So one of the things, and I thought about this a lot in the context of writing about the presidential oath, one of the things that the oath conveys is a presumption of regularity and good faith in the conduct of your job. So, you know, when a federal law enforcement does thing X, we assume it to be valid in the absence of some reason to think it not valid. And I can think of no reason to do that other than that the person has sworn an oath to do a certain job. And so you repose some confidence in the nature of the oath, and that causes you to give a presumption of good faith to the conduct of the job.
Well, there's also a set of norms in these jobs, you know, principles, guidelines, a set of norms that govern behavior. And so if you're learning from people who think that way and behave that way, you're more likely, not perfectly, but more likely to adopt those same norms and guidelines. For instance, my mentors when I was a brand new federal prosecutor were people who believed deeply in this stuff. And that impresses you, right? The first time you have a really tough call, maybe on exculpatory material, Brady, and you talk to a senior person in the office and he says, "Of course we disclose that. There's no contest there. That's how we live our professional lives in this place that you now inhabit." You remember that. I mean, you're looking for guidance as a young prosecutor, as a young agent. And when you get the right guidance, and you know it's right because it feels right and it sounds right and it smells right, it guides the rest of your professional life. Again, I understand how corny this may sound to some people, but in that environment in which I grew up professionally, it made perfect sense.
All right. So how, you know, Lawfare is not a general law site. We're obviously focused on the sort of national security stuff. Is that set of norms and that set of expectations conditioned by the oath heightened, about the same as or less in the national security arena than in all other walks of life in which, you know, in mob prosecutions or in garden variety criminal law? Are we in an area where the oath matters or accentuates things in the national security arena, or is it no different from any other arena that way?
Hard question for me to answer. I imagine it's the same because you're drawing basically the same types of people, the same types of men and women, whether they end up working, you know, Russian organized crime or national security or drug cases. And by the way, people who do one of those things often end up doing those other things too. It's rather fluid. So I imagine because it's the same type of person, it probably has the same type of impact.
But I wanna push you on that because I can make an argument. And I've never had to swear an oath, and so I've never had my oath tested. But
oh, you have. I'm sure you have in many ways because you make professional judgments, and you, Ben, I know you outside of this room as somebody who is deeply principled and you know, deeply concerned about doing the right thing.
Sure, but I've never run a high stakes case, right? I've never been in the situation in which I've had situations that, you know, test my principles, whatever. I've never had the situation in which having sworn an oath to uphold the law and protect the country against enemies foreign and domestic, I have been put in a situation where I have had to measure my conduct against that oath, particularly in a high-stakes situation. So in the national security arena, it seems to me both that the consequences of failure being amplified over normal stuff, there is a greater level of temptation to cut corners in a fashion that may violate an oath or may, you know, push against it. In addition, there is a greater consequence of the violation itself for the functioning of the rule of law and the system. And so it seems to me you have this special case in this area where there's both more temptation to do it, more potential benefit of doing it in the way of protecting the country, and also greater potential consequences of doing it for the rule of law.
Yeah, I guess I just haven't seen that. I mean, when I've been around folks in high-stakes national security matters, they are the same people, literally and figuratively, as the folks, you know, working a fraud case or a public corruption case, right, or a stolen property case. They're cut from the same cloth. I take your point, right? Stakes seem higher, right? Consequences may be greater. So therefore, perhaps, as you would, I don't know that you're arguing, but you're positing that the temptation.
I'm asking.
Yeah, that the temptation is greater. I've not seen that. One of the things, so I'm a very, very rule-oriented person. It's one of the reasons I think I was comfortable in federal law enforcement and in the national security arena. By and large, that's the type of people that are attracted to it, you know, and so the oath doesn't shape the behavior of somebody who is inclined to violate it. It reinforces the notions that many of us bring to that arena. And because we take it publicly and because we care a lot about what the community, I don't just mean our colleagues, but the defense bar and the court, right, and others with whom we work, because we care deeply about our reputations in that professional environment, we tend to abide it. I don't think the oath will ever take a lawbreaker and make them into a law abider.
Right. So one of the paradoxes of the oath is that you wouldn't and shouldn't trust in a position that requires the oath anybody for whom you would actually rely on their oath as opposed to their character to deliver the result.
It is not in and of itself sufficient. And I imagine when I read your book that you will probably make arguments along that line.
I want to ask you a question that you've been asking your guests, which is, or a variant of it, which is, you know, tell me about the time that in your professional life, you kind of looked back and said, okay, here's what the situation arguably calls on me to do, but I swore this oath and therefore, you know, not that.
Yeah, again, I don't know that it was ever quite that stark. I don't know that I ever had to go into my office, shut the door, pull out a copy of the oath, and reread it to remind myself of what my obligation was. Again, I think the people drawn to that type of work, and it's not just law enforcement, again, to be clear, in many walks of life and in many public capacities, it is simply the starting point for a career of service, to abide by the rules and the norms and the ethos of the place that you inhabit. I don't think I ever said to myself, what would my oath require? I may have said to myself, what does the law require? What would my colleagues expect? What's the right thing to do here? But that's all in the end been grounded in the oath I took.
So what are the plans for the podcast in the future? Is it a discrete series that's going to end when it ends, or are you planning to continue it?
So MSNBC and NBC very gracious, gave me a full season of 10 episodes. We are close to finishing all 10. After that, we will see. I think so far so good, but I don't want to suppose I know what they want me to do next. And, you know, this is true. I'm like incredibly grateful that they trusted me with this, even if it turns out to be nothing more than one season and 10 episodes. Thought that was pretty cool. And it also lets me talk to people, as we said at the beginning of this podcast, that I really like, and that I trust, and that I admire, and to talk to them about stuff sort of outside of the daily news cycle.
Often the stuff that makes them interesting in the daily news cycle.
Well, that's right. I mean, and I think Jim Comey is a really interesting guy. I think Andy McCabe talks eloquently about his first office assignment as a special agent in New York. I think Preet is incredibly eloquent when he talks about difficult cases in the Southern District of New York and how they debated them internally and how, you know, in the end, they had to make a decision and go one way or the other. Lisa Monaco has one of the most interesting careers in federal government. She worked in all three branches. And all of that helped inform her judgment when she ended up as President Barack Obama's Homeland Security Advisor. They are, frankly, interesting people, and it's a privilege to get to talk to them.
It's a privilege to talk to you. Chuck, thanks so much for coming in.
And thanks for doing this, Ben. I appreciate it. It's Lawfare is a really cool thing that you got going, and I am an avid reader and listener.
Appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Chuck Rosenberg for coming on the show. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a rating and 5-star review wherever you found us. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.